The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The very latest overnight, the White House unveiling a three-phase approach for states to start reopening amid the coronavirus pandemic, some before May the 1st. President Trump says he'll leave it to individual governors to decide what is best for their states. But this morning, at least 16 states, including New York, along with Washington, D.C., have already extended stay-at-home orders either well into May or indefinitely. Meantime, cases of the virus are still rising nationwide, now more than 671,000, with nearly 35,000 fatalities.
This morning, workers and business owners nationwide are desperate for relief. 22 million Americans have now filed for unemployment benefits in the last 4 weeks alone, as more companies like Yelp and Groupon announce thousands of new layoffs. Small businesses are struggling to make it through this pandemic, too. The $349 billion Paycheck Protection Program, designed to keep small businesses afloat and their employees paid, dried up on Thursday. Demand for the forgivable loans was so overwhelming that the Small Business Administration said it processed more than 14 years' worth of loans in less than 14 days.
Just if you're keeping track, S&P is down 18% from the highs, which is technically out of that bear market phase and a lot better than where we looked in March.
Absolutely. Look, we're down 14% year to date. As Tom alluded to, we rebounded about 24% now off the lows, retraced nearly 50% of the losses in March. That being said, we do think some of this may have come too far, too fast. You know, we really were driven by, one, the virus and the health issues perhaps stabilizing here, which is good news. The stimulus from both the Fed and the fiscal broadly being quite strong, quite fast. I think that's another piece of good news. But at this point, you know, to us, the risk-reward doesn't seem nearly as compelling. We're facing some key unknowns ahead of us. What does the reopening of the economy look like, especially now with an unemployment rate close to 18% after this morning's jobless claims numbers? And a consumer that's really quite cautious still. You know, keep in mind, this U.S. economy is driven by consumption and the U.S. consumer.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Open for business coming soon. At least that is the hope as President Trump announces plans to allow states to reopen the country. Meanwhile, the virus continues to take its toll on unemployment. This week, 5.2 million Americans filed for unemployment, bringing jobless claims up to 20 million since the start of the shutdowns. But stocks are in a rally mode for a second week of gains. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in the hour will be Ralph Ancampora, who predicted the downturn a week before it started. Ralph feels the bottom is in on stocks, although there may be another pullback. Ralph is optimistic, and you're going to want to hear why. Next on the program, Professor Silla, who's co-author of The Bible on the History of Interest Rates, joins me. He believes higher inflation and higher interest rates are in our future. Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. Well, this week there is a lot that was going on. Let's talk about some of the major catalysts. And that was mainly what was going on in oil markets, as well as the reopening plan for America that was announced on Thursday afternoon. So let's get into it. OPEC and non-OPEC members decreased the production numbers by 9.7 million barrels from May 1st to June 3rd, and then will taper down to a decrease of 7.7 million barrels per day from July 1st to December 31st, and then down to 5.8 million barrels per day starting next year, all the way through April 30th of 2022. So pretty far out, but you know, tapering after a couple of months here, and then next year. Oil still fell on the news, suggesting that investors really didn't think it was enough. And that consensus was echoed by the IEA's report on Wednesday, I think it was Wednesday, that for April, the cuts announced won't rebalance the oil market immediately due to the record drop in demand. And the key highlight from the report was their expectation of oil demand would fall by 9.3 million barrels for this entire year, year over year. So maybe a recovery at the end of the year, pretty severe drop right now. Their expectation for the month in front of us shows that OPEC's cuts are really far away from the expectation. They're expecting demand to drop by 29 million barrels per day from a year ago, April, and 23.1 million barrels for the quarter versus a year ago. So humongous demand destruction there. So you can see why oil prices really didn't rally this week on the news of those cuts. So stocks rallied throughout the week based on hopes of a coordinated plan from federal and state officials on the reopening of business and when that set date would be. And so we got that news. In addition to that, there was a study being done at the University of Chicago Medicine that showed promising results from Gilead Sciences' therapy drug. I can't pronounce the name, so I'm not going to even try. Remdesivir, something like that. But it's having some effect with severe cases of COVID-19. There's a lot of discussion that it was analogous, that it's not a pure scientific study. So there's a lot of discussion about that, but it was nevertheless something that the market liked hearing. After those announcements at the end of the day on Thursday, we saw futures go up as a result. So let's talk about the Reopen America plan. And that was the second to last catalyst I thought the bulls needed to have this rally persist. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I think it's the last catalyst that we really needed to see. But obviously, I think the next part is when will each state open up? It's going to be at the state level, not the federal level. The plan was released Thursday after the market closed, and that really pushed futures higher overnight and helped Friday's uptick. So Trump has indicated that states can begin to reopen by May 1st. So that's the earliest that any state can do it, but should adhere to some guidelines mentioned in the three-phase plan. So there's phase 1, 2, and 3, basically saying phase 1 is the most strict, and phase 2 and 3 would be less strict. But the White House administration has turned the bulk of the decision to reopen over the states, as I kind of expected, because the virus is affecting each state differently. Look at the deaths in New York and California and other states, and then a much lesser degree in other states. And I think that was also the safest political move for Trump to make. If he forced the country to open and it backfired, it would really have backfired on voter confidence. And I think looking at what New York Governor Cuomo has extended the stay-at-home order now to mid-May, so May 15th. And Governor Newsom of California announced that he gave some basic guidelines of what he'd like to see before he makes the decision. So no set date there. There are still a lot of unknowns for this market recovery, and I'd really like to talk a little bit more about that. Even though this isn't really a specific catalyst for this week, these are things that I think investors need to have in mind. A little intermediate term, little big picture here. Let's talk about the economic results, which have been just abysmal. And so far haven't fazed this bear market recovery all that much. Retail sales were down 8.7% in March. Industrial production declined 5.4% in March. The regional surveys, which have started to come out on April's numbers, show incredible downtick. The Empire State Survey was down in April to -78.2. That's the worst on record. And the Philadelphia Fed Index fell to -56.6. That is the lowest since July of 1980. Housing starts have declined 22% in March. The increase in unemployment claims wasn't as bad as last week, but increased yet another 5.25 million on Thursday. That was announced. But stocks, like I said, continue to rise on the hope of a V-bottom in the economy and a reopening of businesses, yet we don't know what that's really going to look like yet. So if the best case scenario doesn't happen and new cases continue to hold steady, let's just say right now I think new cases are right around a flat 5%. If we see that continue, we could see up to 5.8 million total cases of COVID-19 by the end of next May. So just another month if the new cases continues to stay at the current rate. Now, new cases have been following since April 8th. They peaked at around 34,055 new cases. However, in the last 2 days, Thursday and Wednesday, they started picking up again. And in fact, on Thursday, reached up to almost that level that we saw peak on April 8th, right around 34,000. So like I said, if they're not going the right way, they're supposed to continue to decline. We want to continue to see that before everything reopens on May 1st for some states. It's going to be terrible if it doesn't and we reopen. So that's my biggest worry, that this reopening on May 1st is premature for some areas, given, like I said, the data that we've seen in just the last couple of days. It's a highly contagious virus, and carriers can be asymptomatic, meaning they have it, but they don't show signs and can be contagious at that point. So in case you haven't seen the numbers from the cases that have now closed, meaning they're no longer an active COVID-19 case, it appears that on average, around 62% recover and about 38% have died. That is tragic. That is terrible. That is staggering. And while the total cases only represent 0.2% of the total population due to the shut-in, which has been effective, it just happens that if new cases don't continue to decline and as we go back to normal, we could see the total population numbers, we could continue to see a linear increase, potentially exponential. Hopefully not. You know, we don't want that exponential increase. Linear, at least, has been so far the best case scenario that we've had so far. As I said a couple of weeks ago, we're now in the midst of the most, I think, difficult phase for investing during this pandemic, because we've had a lot of catalysts now that we were hoping to see: fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus, and now getting back to an open economy partially. And again, what does that finally look like? Because there were just guidelines that were given by the Open America plan. We don't have specifics. We don't have specific results. So when is this economy going to recover? I gave you a few of those terrible economic numbers. We don't know. And that's, I think, the most difficult phase of this pandemic is right in front of us. According to FactSet, let's talk about earnings, because that started this week. The forward earnings per share estimate for the S&P 500 is $155.68. That's down about 12% from its level on February 19th, when the S&P 500 was trading at 19 times earnings. At 28.45, the last time I checked, I think we're still open here on Friday as we're recording. We're right now at about 18.3 times earnings. So let's talk about that 12% decline in earnings. Is that too optimistic? I think so. You know, during the financial crisis, earnings dropped 35%, and Goldman Sachs recently has said that the downturn could be 4 times worse, but also said that the recovery in the second half would be unprecedented. So that's obviously the light at the end of this tunnel. But speaking of earnings, this week we got a lot of the financial institutions reporting, and the biggest thing that they're talking about, and almost across the board, is very large provisions for credit losses. Now they see where this could be going, potentially. So again, is a 12% decline in earnings overly optimistic? In my opinion, it is. And is this rally, which has taken us up to a valuation of 18 times earnings, is that overly done? Again, I believe so. So I'm trying not to be bearish here. On the contrary, we put a large amount of buy orders into technology and individual large cap names mid-March to late March. And we're very happy with those positions, probably plan to keep those positions. But I don't think that we're looking at a V bottom in the economy. And we've seen a V bottom so far in the stock market. And I think that's due to sentiment and due to positioning. You know, sentiment is an issue with a very large amount of cash positions for money managers who have been sitting out this rally. I think the numbers were rather large last week, but by now are probably feeling some performance anxiety, as the rally has been also staggering, up almost 30%. From the bottom for the S&P 500. So if they're putting money to work right now, I think that's crazy. But, you know, to each their own. And by the way, the treasury rates, something you should see following stock prices. We should be seeing treasury rates rising in an environment where the market is going up with the belief of economic recovery. That's not happening. Treasury rates are still very low at, I think, 0.65% for the 10-year treasury last I looked. So again, if this rally is to be honest with itself, the credit market should be following suit. And so let me tell you what we've been doing. We put on a hedge and have lowered our equity exposure this week, just due to how fast the recovery has happened and still a lot of unknowns on the fundamentals. And that's where we're at. So that's it for this week. A lot happening. I don't have all the time to go over everything, but I think those are the key events this week. What's going on in OPEC and oil? I think keeping oil prices down is the demand destruction that's going on there. And the supply cuts are just not enough. And then again, the reopening plan for the U.S., some positive results from Gilead's therapy drug, but a lot ahead of us. We'll stay in touch on this. And next week, I'm excited. I'll probably dig in a lot more on earnings and just what's going on, because we're beginning the thick of it. This was just the first week and mostly financial reporting. And weeks up ahead, we should have a lot of tech You know, that's what's been outperforming. If you look at the S&P's performance, and you strip out technology and you strip out some of the very key companies there, the S&P equal weighting is down, I think, 20%. So that's a lot worse than being around only down, I think, 12%. So anyways, that's it for this week. True tests, again, right in front of us is the reopen premature or not. That will be up to the states to decide. But back to you, Jim. I'm very excited to hear what you and Ralph think about this incredible rally we've seen it and whether it can last in the intermediate term and in what we have in front of us long term, given the incredible bear market that we have experienced.
FS Insider spoke with Louis Gaab, the CEO of GaabCal Research, on our podcast this week to talk about the post-COVID-19 investment landscape, how he sees things playing out, and also to share his three highest conviction calls. Here's a clip of what he told listeners.
Bottom line, you're seeing today big policy divergence between Asia and the Western world. And what's interesting to me amidst this policy divergence is that the market seems to be liking what they're seeing in Asia a little more. This is the first crisis in my lifetime, and you know, I'm 46 years old. I've been in Asia for more than the past 20 years. This is the first market crisis in my lifetime where not only do I see Asia outperforming in the crisis, but outperform with a much lower volatility. Usually, you know, in a crisis, Asia is the red-haired stepchild, right? It's the one that gets beaten up the most. This time around, complete different reaction from the market. And to me, that makes sense. That makes sense because, frankly, policy is much more predictable in Asia today than in the Western world, because I think that the policy response in Asia through this crisis has been superior than the policy response you've seen in Western countries.
If you'd like to hear this full interview with Louis Gaab and a long list of guests that we speak with, many of which people are paying thousands and thousands of dollars to listen to at one single conference, go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, despite some of the difficulties in the economy, the market seems to be holding up. We've got some bad numbers, and as we've been talking on the show, those numbers are going to get worse as we go forward, just like it did when the virus began. Well, where does the market go from here? Joining me on the program is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, I want to talk about a couple of things and point out to our listeners, the last time I had you on the show was a Friday before the market peaked, and that was in February. And you said it was looking like a major correction was coming. Boy, did you nail that one. And previous to that, we had you on the show in September of 2018, and you saw another storm. So I guess my first question I want to ask, how can I buy your crystal ball?
Well, you got to come to the farm. And a Wall Street museum that I have.
Well, it's quite, if anybody's seen Ralph's farm, he's got a history of the Dow markets going back. Well, Ralph, when did you begin there? Did it begin in the 19th century?
Well, I went back to the beginning of record, and it starts with the Cowles Index. Cowles Index was created by a man by the Alfred E. Cowles, which, by the way, the Cowles Index becomes the S&P 500 in 1957. And the Cowles Index starts in 1871. So I start right there with the market. I have everything. I have all the recessions and panics and all of the presidents and all the events, important events that happened. It's all labeled on my barn wall. It goes all around the whole outside of the, it's a very large building. And it's, I think you'll really enjoy it. I've had a lot of guests out there. In fact, I had the dean of St. Thomas University, where I give some lectures to the students, and she came out with the students. And when she went through, I gave her a tour, and she turned to me, she said, "You have to write a book and a video on this." And that's what I'm in the process of doing right now.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Ralph, let's go to a presentation you put together. And we're going to make your presentation, by the way, available on our website. So if you're listening to Ralph talk about various things, that presentation will be on the website. Let's talk about trends and sentiment in the market, because the sentiment indicators are at extreme. I wonder if you can address that.
Well, if you go to slide 5 in my presentation, you could talk about the popular one that a lot of people on TV look at. It's the VIX index. The VIX index, as you know, is the CBOE options on the S&P 500. And on the right-hand side of my screen there, you can see how, well, of course, you can see the S&P 500 collapsing due to the virus, of course. And then the VIX index explodes to the upside, and much, much more fear than I compared it to the bottom in December of 2018. The last time we had the VIX up at this level was in 1987. I'm sure you remember that one very vividly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. That was when that Black Monday, when the Dow dropped 20% in a day. And that was scary. That day, I got to tell you, myself and a lot of us who just stood there just breathless. And it was amazing. But what I wanted to do is present to you all the magnitude of the fear. And rightly so. Come on. I had everybody so confused this whole pandemic. The next slide I want to show you is another version of sentiment. And this is the put-call ratio. And a dear old friend of mine, Marty Zweig, had created this many, many, many years ago. And it's, of course, the puts and calls. It's positive versus negative vehicles in which to participate in the stock market. And a ratio above 1.6 is usually the level that you've hit intensive bearishness by these put-call players. And on March 23rd, it actually hit 1.8.
Wow.
And I give you a whole series of years going back, and you can see the last few times that we've had that bigger reading, and it was coincident with the important turning points. So that was another indicator that I wanted to share with everyone, talking about the intensity of the fear in the marketplace. And, you know, it was Warren Buffett that said, be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful. I think it's apropos to this period of time. I mean, people even today, and rightly so, I'm not glossing over anything. There's all sorts of reasons to be negative. But, you know, the market has a tendency to build in all of the fear, all of the knowledge that people are, or the expectations that people are looking for. And I think most of it is already in the market. And the next fearful indicator I want to show you is the AAII bearish sentiment indicator. For many, many years, I used to be a regular speaker at their various meetings around the country, and it's called the American Association of Individual Investors. This is not these are not professional traders or anything. These are individuals. Many of them were doctors and lawyers. They're very sophisticated people. And what AAII does every week is they take a tally of all their members, thousands and thousands of these retail investors. And whenever you have a preponderance of them, more than 50% of them are bearish, the less bullish. And I could show you the indicators here, and you could see the historic going back to, I think I have it back to 1999, where you could see at major turning points that bearish indicator spikes. So this is my third example of fear. And that I think is since March 23rd, I think that was the maximum fear of most of these indicators that I'm showing you. And the last one I want to show you is a couple down there. It's the, well, I'm getting very technical for a second. We talk about moving averages. I question whether a lot of people understand what they are, but a moving average is a momentum line. It's a mathematical trend line in English. And if in this case, I'm looking at a 40-week moving average, 40 weeks, it's roughly 10 months. So that's got to be the average of over the last 10 months, average price. And I'd say that was a long-term indicator. And in this diagram that I have you for here, and it gives you all the circles, that on March 23rd, on that low, 80% of all the stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, 80% of them were below that 10-month moving average. That's a long-term trend line. In technical terms, we say your market is extremely oversold. In other words, only 20% of the stocks were above that trend line. Again, if you go back in time, and I have a few years back there where you can see, you get that deeply oversold on a momentum basis, you're usually near the bottom. So when I look at the fear and the greed, you know, I didn't live through 1929, but I wrote about it, and we were down 89.4%. But what was interesting then, the president of the United States, Herbert Hoover, kept saying, oh, don't worry, it's just a short-term problem. Well, it wasn't a short-term problem. And the Federal Reserve, by the way, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. So they were about 16 years old, and they still didn't know what they were doing. So they really weren't helpful in that crash. And if you compare that with the second worst decline in the Dow's history, we just went through it a few years ago. All of us lived through 07 to 09. That was the second worst Dow decline. The Dow dropped 55.9%. And guess what? Thank God, Ben Bernanke was at the head of the Federal Reserves at the time and did all the right things. He supported the system. In fact, he did his PhD thesis on the crash of 1929 and the Great Depression. So he knew what went wrong, and he knew how to fix it. So, and what's interesting about this time, it has nothing to do with the banking system. It's obviously a contagion that we have no control over. And recently, not too long ago, Ben Bernanke was on TV saying, go big, go big. So I think the Federal Reserve is doing the right thing. And we had a lot of fear. And I'm sorry for the long-winded commentary, but I think you've made your love.
You know, what's interesting, you mentioned 1987. I remember that, Ralph, because the Friday before the Monday drop, the market was down 10%. And the only reason I remembered that is I sent in the money for our company's pension plan on a Friday. It got to the mutual fund on Monday. And of course, Monday, the market was down 23%. And when you send money to a mutual fund, they buy at the closing price at the end of the day. That's the only time I bought at the bottom of the market, and it was all done by accident.
I'll take it anytime.
Yeah. So how, you know, this is the thing that really struck me about this downturn. What were we down? Down about 38% from peak to trough on the Dow. It happened quickly. Not as quick as what we saw in 87, but in similar magnitude in such a short period of time.
Yeah, no, it's, what's the old saying? History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. You know, there are different causes for every bull and bear market. And this time around, of course, it's something like hopefully we never ever see again. I have to tell you, I like everyone else, listen to the TV shows, and there's so much gloom and doom out there. I wish they would put themselves on mute and talk about the positive things. And when I was a young analyst, as a writer, I started writing market letters in Wall Street. The old bosses of mine, these wonderful old gentlemen, they were in their 70s. They come to me and say, Ralph, when you start writing, close your eyes and try to picture what the headlines in the Wall Street Journal are going to be 6 months from today. That's how you write your market letter.
Wow.
And you know what? If you close your eyes and think of what is going to be six months from now, I think it'll be a lot better.
I do, too. And what makes this rather unique, unlike other bear markets that we have experienced in recessions, they were financially related. The Fed was raising interest rates. The economy was overheating. This was all government-induced. Basically, the government was shutting down the economy. I don't know about you, Ralph, but here in California, we've been quarantined for a month. I think people are going stir-crazy. And it'll be interesting to see what happens once we come out of this. I want to ask you a question, something that has always stuck with me was something you said. And I asked this of you in 2018, and you were predicting a market downturn, which actually played out. It was one of the biggest drops that we saw in a short period of time in that quarter. And you told the story about your wife and dividend stocks, and you owned these high quality companies, and you say you just held them and kept them. Have you done that this time?
Yes, we have. I got to tell you, she's very, very nervous. And I have to hold her hand every morning because a lot of it is dividends. And many of them have been canceled, at least temporarily anyway. Yeah, but I think it was J.P. Morgan said, I always forget this quote correctly. he who was bearish on the U.S. economy will always go broke. He said that in 1895.
Oh, so applicable, because, you know, the one thing about this country is I'm always amazed at the innovation and the talent of entrepreneurs in this country, which has always made this country great. Ralph, when you look at all of this, let's kind of narrow this down now. What looks the best? I mean, you were looking at one of your presentations, and we're going to make your presentation, by the way, available on our website. So if you're listening to Ralph talk about various things, that presentation will be on the website, and you can take a look at what we've been talking about. I want to go back to sector trends and tell us what that is telling you.
Well, the sectors that have held up relatively well in this environment are the ones that you want to participate in, at least if you at least nibble at in any kind of a pullback. I see as we're having this interview, the market is pulling back today, and rightly so, because of the unemployment numbers and et cetera being flashed this morning, and they're scary. So I'd say the areas that look interesting to me are technology, healthcare. And you look at the some of the industrials, and I think any kind of a pullback, you would like to start adding to those. But if you don't have them, initiate positions into stocks like Microsoft and Apple, things like that.
Let's talk about one other sector that's doing well. Yeah, it's another asset class, and that is gold. What's your take on gold here?
Oh, I'm very optimistic on gold. I have been for a while. And if I'm sorry, I don't have a picture of it, but if you go back, if you can get a long-term graph of gold, you know, let's say a 20-year picture, you know, and of course the peak was around 1900. I think that was in 2011. Then we had the huge decline, went down to about 1,000. And for about 5-6 years, I could be wrong on that, maybe 7 years, it just stayed very flat. For a technician, that was, I say, a major base. I was turned on to gold a while ago, way before the problems that we had today. Just in and of itself, gold was starting to act in a more positive way. It had all those years of stabilizing in the 1,000, 1,200 area level for quite some time. And it was starting to move up in a gradual way. And the family funds that I advised, we got in there, I'd say about a year or so ago. Of course, with the virus, it's really spiked up. So the fear factor is in there. But prior to that, the move up in gold was not because of the virus. And of course, right now, I think the last I looked, it was a little over $1,700 an ounce. So long term, with or without the virus, I'd say if you can get gold back down a little bit, maybe you want to nibble buy some. And I'm looking for all-time new highs over $1,900. In the not too distant future.
And finally, I'd like to get your take on interest rates here. I mean, we're looking at treasury yields. It was interesting. 2 weeks ago, the yield on a 3 and a 6 month T-bill actually got negative. What's your take on interest rates? They go lower? Have we bottomed? Where do we go from here?
I got to tell you, I guess the ultimate support level is zero. I hate saying that. No, I don't really have a major opinion on interest rates, except to say I somewhere down in here, I think it's you're gonna probe for the bottom. I don't see it going negative like they have in Europe.
And the other thing I'd like to point out, we have a graph. I wrote a story and put it on the web, and it's the dividend yield on the Dow minus the yield on a 10-year Treasury. And Ralph, this is the highest that's been in 25 years.
Wow!
And who would have thought that some of the best income yields are those dividend-paying stocks that your wife likes so much.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yep.
That's what she's doing.
Yeah, so.
Taking good care of me.
She has. Well, that's quite a farm you have, and it's quite a barn. I hope one day to come out there and see it.
Did you see the pictures on the screen?
Oh, yeah. And, if you're listening to the show, we're going to put Ralph's presentation on our website, and you can see Ralph's barn where he's got a history well over 100 years of the market itself. How big is your barn, by the way? That thing looks huge.
Oh, yeah. It's about 80 feet long, about 35 feet wide, and it goes all the way around. I got the whole thing. I got enough for another 35 years, so I want to be putting that last bar chart on the, okay. on the down 35 years.
Well, should we be so lucky? I'd love to be interviewing you in 35 years.
Okay.
All right. Well, listen, Ralph, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe, my friend, and say hello to your wife for us.
All right. Will do. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This week on FS Insider, we had a fascinating conversation with Mary Kelly, a former naval commander who spent over 20 years on active duty in intelligence and logistics. She's also an author of 13 books on leadership, money, and business to discuss all of the different changes that she sees coming from the coronavirus.
This virus is not just going to go away. It's not just going to go away forever and we're going to walk away from it. This virus is going to stick around and we're going to have to deal with some of the health precautions for years until we've got enough antibodies. So it's not just changing how we look at things. It's changing how people physically work at work. Factories are going to be impacted by this as they go to more automation because people have to work further apart in factories. So boards are going to have to be looking at, if they don't have these people in place, hiring people who are wildly proactive, far-thinking visionaries, people who are going to take what's happening right now and not just say, okay, let's put a Band-Aid on it and move forward. No, we've got to be able to take this crisis, and it is a terrible crisis, and figure out how this is going to shift our industry forever. Like the Industrial Revolution, the Agricultural Revolution changed things. This is going to be the evolution economy time that we look back at and say, this is never going to be the same.
If you'd like to hear this full interview with Mary Kelly, in addition to our other interviews airing 3 days every week on FS Insider, through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, since its original publication in 1963, A History of Interest Rates has become the Bible and authority on interest rates. It was originally written by Solomon Brothers partner Sidney Homer and has been updated by Richard Silla. He's Professor Emeritus of Economics and former Henry Kaufman Professor of Financial Institutions and Markets at New York's University Stern School of Business. And it is now in its fourth edition. Professor, how would you describe the world that we find ourselves in today? Because when I read your book, you know, it seemed like for a good amount of time, with the exception of maybe during Babylonian times when interest rates were at 20% and a brief period in the late 70s where it got almost up there, but they've sort of varied between 3 to 6% on average, maybe 12%. During Roman inflationary periods, but how would you contrast interest rates today, where in parts of the world like Europe and Asia, they're negative?
Well, I think it's unprecedented. We were seeing the lowest interest rates in recorded human history, as you mentioned. By the way, I think that peak wasn't in the late 70s. It was actually 1981 when we had 15% on government bonds and 20% on bank loans. And so that was just almost 40 years ago. I guess it's 39 years ago now that we had about the highest rates in U.S. history. And now, four decades later, we've seen the lowest rates in U.S. history and all around the world. You know, our rates have briefly been negative, but Europe and Japan have seen negative rates for some time now. In fact, there's a huge amount of debt. I've seen estimates of $10 to $15 trillion of debt, and mostly European bonds, probably sovereign bonds, are showing negative rates. So this is really unprecedented. And one of the themes of our book, of course, is that there are cycles of interest rates. They trend down for a while, they trend up for a while. I have to say, we've been trending down for 40 years now, and that's 39 years, and that's kind of at the outside limits of, you know, usually they reverse around, 3 to 4 decades after they've been trending one way. So I'm kind of wondering whether that historical pattern will hold now.
And Professor, is there any linkage between the amount of debt? I mean, if you look at the amount of debt in the, especially now with this coronavirus, the stimulus package, we may have $3 trillion deficits, and the national debt was around $24 trillion. It may be going up to $27 and $30 trillion here in the next couple of years. Is there any relation between interest rates and how high they get or how low they get and the amount of debt in the economy?
Well, I think there is a relationship, obviously, because the government is in there basically borrowing a lot of money to finance its deficits. I think the nearest analogy might be to a wartime. You know, the governments borrow a lot of money in wars, and, you know, people are referring to this coronavirus as placing us into a war. We have a war not with a, I think President Trump says, an invisible enemy, the virus. And I think what's going on now, massive increases in government spending, plus in some sense removing some of our workers from the labor force so they go in the army. I mean, we're doing that in a massive way now when we shut down restaurants and hotels and cruise lines. That's causing a lot of removal of labor from the labor force. And I think one of the lessons of history is that in wartime, these great demands plus production being either altered or moved to other types of activity, one of the results is inflation. And I haven't heard many people talking about it yet, but I've studied the history of U.S. wars, and we had almost a hyperinflation during the American Revolution. We had inflation during the War of 1812. The Civil War, of course, the price level doubled from 1861 to 1864. World War I, the price level doubled. World War II, the price level doubled after the war, you know, when they took the price controls off. And, you know, if we're in a war with the virus now, I think, especially investors, historians, should be thinking about what happens usually when you have a war is that there are inflationary pressures. Now, what is the impact of that on interest rates? Well, I think if prices start to go up, people will want to, who lend money, will want to have some protection for what they lend. And maybe the bond vigilantes, remember them from the 1990s, the bond vigilantes, which controlled what the government...
Yeah, what happened to them?
Well, I think we got rates so low, but the secret was we got inflation down to low levels. You know, the Federal Reserve has been apologizing for not meeting its 2% target. Despite all its efforts, it had trouble getting up to its 2% target. And so I think the bond market vigilantes said, well, you know, the Fed has got a pretty low inflation target and it can't even reach that. So we don't have to worry that much about inflation. And that may, well, that seems to have been true for the last couple of decades, maybe three decades now. So the bond market vigilantes went into hibernation, one might say. But they may come back now that we're actually fighting a war against the virus with massive increases in government spending and taking some of our workers away from their jobs. So most other wars we've had resulted in some inflation. I have a feeling in my bones that we'll see some of that inflationary pressure as well.
Yeah, and especially, right now we've had a disinflationary environment and a deflationary impact as a result of shutting down economies, and especially with energy and this not only destruction in demand as economies contract and as we quarantine, there's less people on planes driving their cars on the road when they're staying at home. But when we come out of this and the prices of oil go from $22 a barrel back to 40 or 50, and then also this tremendous amount of money that's being pumped into the economy, I can't help but see an inflationary impact. I want to talk about something else about interest rates, and that is the impact of these extraordinary low interest rates on people like savers, on institutions like insurance companies that try to earn a rate of return on the float between the money they take in and what they pay out. And then also, for example, pension funds like my own state of California, CalPERS, where their stated return is they need to earn 7.5% to meet their pension obligations.
Well, I think that's going to be a big problem. Those pension funds, you know, they have a kind of funny way of accounting. Some of the regulations allow them to pretend that they earned their 7% return, even if they didn't. But I think you can only go on that way for a little while before reality catches up with you. And obviously, nobody's getting a 7% return unless you go into, you know, very low-rated, high-yield debt. Even there, you know, that getting 7 or 7.5% is difficult. Of course, that's not too far off the long-run rate of return on equities. But now with our elevated levels in the stock market, I think even moving into equities isn't going to save a pension fund that much. And So I think, you know, this is a real problem. You mentioned California and CalPERS. The state of Illinois has tremendous obligations, which are unfunded. And I think it's they're in worse shape than a lot of states. But it's a widespread problem. And you mentioned the insurance companies as well. They're selling annuities. And if you have an annuity at today's interest rates, you have to put up a lot of capital to get a decent amount of income coming from it. So it's a major problem. I think we've suppressed interest rates. I think the main reason for it is the dot-com bubble deflated 20 years ago, and the Fed moved interest rates down to lower levels from down to 1%. Then we had the financial crisis a decade ago, and the Fed moved interest rates down to about zero and followed up with the quantitative easing measures. Now we've got the coronavirus crisis, and the Fed has again pushed interest rates down to very low levels. I think that, you know, there are reasons for that, but it has created the problems you said. Anyone that's living on fixed income is having a harder time getting a return. And I don't know when we're going to get back to normal, but I expect we will have to do that one of these days, and maybe things will be a little better then. But in the meantime, the companies you describe and the states and pension funds, they're going to have trouble.
You know, when we take a look at this interest rate environment, and I know this was a policy pursued by the Fed coming out of World War II, they called it financial repression, where they kept the level of interest rates low. And as the economy inflated, those debt levels became less and less in proportion to where the economy was. Do you think we may go through a similar period given the debt levels today and what the Fed may have to do? I mean, if we were to normalize, Professor, and get interest rates back to, let's say, 4 or 5%, that could be a lot of money added to the federal deficit when you're talking about 24 to 30 trillion in debt.
That's certainly true. And those rates you mentioned, they seem sort of, far off in the distant past. But I remember when I was a young man in the late 1950s and 1960s, you would get 4% interest on a government bond, 4.25, 4.5. Of course, rates moved up from there going into the inflation of the 70s. It's going to strain the government's budget. And one of the reasons I worry about inflation, maybe more than most people, is that it would be in the interest of the government having the debt obligations that you're talking about to have some inflation. You know, remember in the 70s in California, they talked about bracket creep and the people were paying more in taxes because we have a progressive tax system, but they weren't getting gains in real income. They were just having their incomes marked up by inflation. I think we may be in for a period like that again, or at least if you can make analogies with history. There's some chance that we will tolerate inflation because it's actually in the interests of debtors to have inflation. And the government is going to be, or it is now, and is going to be even more so in the future, the biggest debtor of all.
And you just have to look at some of those numbers, and the incentive is there. I want to talk a minute on how this might be impacting what the Fed may be doing, inflation, and also what the government may be doing. And this is this MMT theory, modern monetary theory, that basically says if you can issue debt in your own currency, you don't have to worry about default. And, you know, you can always control inflation through taxation. So there seems to be a justification right now, theoretically, to inflate, to spend as much money, and the Fed just kind of mops it up and monetizes it. And nobody's really talking about what you're talking about here, which I see coming, is inflation.
Well, I think that's right. Modern monetary theory is basically money printing. I think they make a valid point that the Fed, the Fed's balance sheet has gone from, a little over $4 trillion up to $6 trillion in the last month or two. And so the Fed, now that we're not on a gold standard, the Fed is under no obligation to convert its paper promises, our currency, into any hard metal. So freed from that constraint, the Fed does have the sort of powers that modern monetary theory says they have. The question is, what will be the results of these policies of money printing? And the modern monetary theory says, well, you can mop it up with higher taxes. I've lived a long time, and I've seen that, when you start talking about raising taxes, especially if you need to do it quickly to stop an inflationary bubble from being created, it doesn't work that way. There'll be a lot of opposition to any tax increases. And so modern monetary theory, I think, is a little bit Goldilocks or Pollyannish when it thinks that it's so easy to stop any inflation through fiscal measures. It's more likely that the inflation will get away from us. And again, I want to reiterate that inflation is in the interests of a lot of people, debtors, for example.
As you look at this, all of it combined, nobody's talking about inflation right now. There's we've been mentioning there is an incentive to inflate this inflation away. When do you think, Professor, we will see the return of the bond vigilantes? I remember a comment made by a political strategist, James Carnville, and he said, if I could be reborn again, I would come back as a bond vigilante because I could intimidate governments. Do you think we ever see the vigilantes return?
Well, I think we will when inflation begins to heat up. You know, it's not a sure thing, but it's certainly, you know, the war analogy, you know, the price level doubled in most of the wars of U.S. history. Now we're fighting another war against the virus. I think when the inflation heats up, you know, the bond market vigilantes came along in the 1960s and 70s when we had the Vietnam War and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society simultaneously without tax increases, and the Fed printed the money then, and we ended up having just rising inflation levels. I think the average from 1965 to 1981 was about 6% a year. And by 1979, 80, 81, when Mr. Volcker came in and put a stop to it, we had double-digit levels of inflation, you know, 10, 12, 13%. So the bond market vigilantes raised interest rates to very high levels in the 1970s, and I think they were still around in the 1990s when James Carville made that famous quote about how powerful the bond market was. And I think we could see it again. You know, we haven't really thought about it for 30 years now because inflation has been under control and the economy's been doing all right most of the time. But when the inflation heats up, and I think there's a good chance of that, that you'll see a return. The bond market vigilantes will come out of hibernation like Rip Van Winkle and begin to raise interest rates. You know, the real interest rate may not change, but the nominal interest rate will adjust by according to inflation.
How would you as an investor be positioning yourself for something like this to return? Right now, Professor, we have gold breaking out. So whether that's signaling a trouble in the economy or it's sniffing out maybe future inflation, you have treasury protected tips, treasuries. How would you position for something like this? Because certainly the topic you and I are talking about, inflation is furthest on the minds of the markets right now or investors.
You know, that's right. I mean, I've even heard people say that the effect of this crisis may be deflationary in the sense that we're shutting down a lot of productive facilities now. And so that's, you know, when we come back on stream, people will be slow to go out and resume their normal ways of shopping. And yet the businesses will be able to make a lot of products. And so some people say the only way they'll be able to move their products will be to cut the prices. I think the consumers will come back as fast as business starts producing again. So I don't really worry about that deflationary aspect of it. But I think we do have to worry about the inflationary aspect of it. I'm surprised that more people aren't talking about that now. It may be that they just haven't studied the history of the wars in U.S. history like I have, and they haven't had any inflation to speak of for 25 or 30 years. And so we've gotten used to having a low level of inflation. That doesn't mean it can never come back. Before 2007, we hadn't had a major financial crisis since the 1930s. But then we had a major financial crisis. So just because we've gotten used to something for two or three decades doesn't mean that something else might not be right around the corner.
The original book written by Sidney Homer was published in 1963. There's been four editions to the book. The last, which you've been participating, was 2005. Professor, if you were to do another edition to this book today, would there be anything that you would change or add that was not in the fourth edition?
Well, I think you mentioned tips. You know, I happen to think that for people who want to have a portfolio that's balanced with equities and fixed income, tips make a lot of sense right now. I mean, I've always thought that a small amount of tips belong to the portfolio, just on the outside chance you might have inflation. But I think now that I see it coming, what happened to bonds in the 1970s when we had a lot of inflation, bond values got marked down. Bond prices fell as the yields went up. That's what happened when interest rates rise a lot. The value of bonds goes down. But if that were to happen again, I think, and you want to have some fixed income in the portfolio, I think a much higher proportion of tips would make sense going forward.
Well, Professor, I just want to congratulate you. The book, A History of Interest Rates, is still considered the Bible of interest rates. It's a fascinating book, going all the way back to 5,000 years of interest rate history. Really gives you a lot of insight as to what happens. And as you bring up in this discussion, you know, we're at war right now, not war in the traditional sense where you got armies lined across each other from the battlefield with tanks, but it's an invisible war against an invisible enemy. And just like in wartime, the government is ramping up, spending money, and also the Fed is behind it and supporting it, much like they did in World War II. So great insights. Thank you, Professor. You know, I have all three versions of this book.
Ah, I see. Well, you know, Sidney died, I think, sometime around 1980 or so, but the book was still selling. And so in the 1980s, they came to me and said, would you like to revise this? And I had used the book and corresponded with Homer when I was doing my PhD thesis in the 1960s. And so I was happy to take on the task, and it was a lot of fun doing it. And I learned a lot, as you often do. You know, to teach, you have to learn. And you know, I learned a lot by working on history of interest rates.
Well, I'll tell you, it's one of my favorites, one of my classics. I hold this book in regard in the same way that I do Graham and Dodd's Security Analysis. Well, Professor, I'd like to thank you for joining us on the program and bringing us up to date. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Stay safe and come back and talk to us again.
Well, I'd be happy to do that. And thanks a lot for a good interview.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everybody, to Smart Macro, where we're going to talk about what's going on with the markets and how we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are navigating the current investment environment for clients and what we're telling others about the current market backdrop. Chris, what is it that you're seeing when you look under the hood of either the stock market itself or the credit markets to know what type of stability we're seeing in the financial markets currently?
You know, last time we spoke, which was about 2 weeks ago, at that point, the Fed was just going into investment grade debt. They hadn't stepped into going into junk bonds. And for that reason, we hadn't seen a significant rise in junk bonds, particularly with the stress in the oil patch. And since then, they have gone into junk bonds, and we got a rally, clearly, in junk bonds. You look at the junk bond ETFs, a lot of those are selling at, I think, as high as 4 to 5% premiums above their net asset value as everyone began to front-run the Fed. So at this stage, or 2 weeks ago, we did see those areas rally. But what I'm noticing this week is while the S&P has been rallying all week, I've been starting to see slowly the creep in credit default swaps on investment grade debt and also high yield debt. So from that perspective, I would say the credit markets aren't confirming the market's recent push this week. And that does cause some concern, particularly when I look at other things like stock market breadth.
Okay, so what is it that you're seeing on the breadth side? What is it that's giving you pause there?
A lot of things I look at is in terms of breadth at the stock market, and there's multiple measures of that. But one of the ones that I'm noticing is looking at the advanced decline line on the S&P. That peaked last week, and that's been heading lower while the stock market's been heading higher. And I believe a lot of that has to do with the heavy lifting that the tech companies are doing in the stock market. We saw Amazon hit a new 52-week high, Netflix hit a new high, Apple's been surging, Microsoft has been surging. So when you look at performance year-to-date through yesterday, the S&P was down 12.84%. Now, if you look at the S&P X technology, it was down 16%, which is roughly in line with the Dow, down 17%. But in the other areas of the market, small cap, mid cap, you're seeing more weakness. Mid caps are still down 26% for the year. Small caps are down 29%. And even the S&P 500 equal weight, so that's all the members have the same weighting. So the S&P equal weight is down nearly 22%, almost, you know, just under double what the S&P is year to date. So that clearly tells you the heavy hitters like Apple, all the faint stocks, they're really pushing this market higher. And that's why I think I'm seeing the divergence relative to stocks. It's because of the tech stocks that are hitting new highs and surging, that they're artificially pushing the market higher while the credit markets are starting to slip here. Looking at advanced decline lines are starting to slip. Breadth is starting to slip. So what that tells me is we probably should be expecting that this initial rally off the lows that we saw last month is probably coming to a conclusion. And I would expect some kind of a pullback ahead. Now, with all the stimulus being thrown at the economy and some positive news on the infection front, and with the possible news that we might start reopening certain parts of the economy, I wouldn't expect a retest of the lows. I think that's off the table with all the stimulus that's been thrown at it. And we're probably likely to get more fiscal stimulus coming from the Treasury with more of small business loans and backstopping of other areas, which is why I don't think we're going to retest the lows. But I do think we're probably going to be kind of backing and filling here for the next couple of weeks. I think probably for the remainder of April. I don't think the market's going to continue to rally at the pace that it's had. If we did that, we'd be hitting new all-time highs in the S&P not too long from now, which to me, it just does not seem rational to expect that. Other things that I'm noticing is looking at interest rate areas. For example, you look at the 10-year treasury. The 10-year treasury yield was beginning to decline all year and it was diverging from new highs in the market. And if you look at it recently, the 10-year treasury bottomed in early March, roughly 2 weeks before the stock market did. But over the last 2 to 3 weeks, treasury yields are getting close to their lows. So that's kind of diverging from what you would think in terms of the stock market. Other measures that, to me, I look to confirm the move in the market, simple beta measures like financials versus utilities, aggressive versus the defensive sector. You look at that ratio, it's been rolling over, and post the bottom, the peak was roughly about a week after the initial bottom. But utilities have continued to outperform the financial sector, and a lot of the rally, it's been led by defensives, healthcare, staples, utilities. It really is a defensive plus technology rally that's kind of leading things recently, which does have me feel that the recent rally is very suspect. Other things that concern me, if you look at European banks, the European bank stock index, that's near the low set in March. We're literally at the lows, and the risk is that we breach those lows. And that would mean that there's a lot of stress that is still present in European banks that could spill over into our banks and our financial markets. Other ratios like the copper gold ratio is still near the lows. Even the German 10-year bund yield is retesting its late March lows, not its ultimate low in early March, but it's not hitting new highs. So that to me kind of tells me that this, beneath the surface, things don't look as strong is what you would think just looking at the S&P.
And even oil too, right? I mean, if we look at West Texas crude, it's at $18. So, I mean, if you were thinking that we were going to see a rebound in the economy, hopefully that would be picked up or sniffed out by oil prices as well. So do you think oil prices are playing an important component in your outlook?
I do. The stress in the junk bond market is clearly off the lows that we saw several weeks ago with the Fed stepping in. But that doesn't mean the stress isn't still there. That doesn't mean that we still couldn't have credit events just because the value of the bonds aren't near their lows that we saw previously. You look at oil companies, there's still an incredible amount of stress. You look at the municipal market, for example, municipality districts and state and local governments, they're relying on tax revenue from retail sales, tax revenue from gasoline stations. We're all driving less. We're all shopping less. All of these things are going to hurt the revenue side for municipal and local governments. And that's why the Fed, I believe, stepped in into the municipal market. But you got to think even beyond that. Think about mall operators. A recent report I saw says that local mall operators are only receiving roughly 15 to 20% of their normal rent. So think about those who have capital, who are investing. A lot of these people, even those who own apartment buildings and smaller, real estate investors, they're really hurting in terms of their income, and they're not being supported by the market and by the local government. So, there's still a lot of stress that I think the market's overlooking. There's a lot of potential economic fallout, and the longer we stay at home And even if we start to move away from staying home and start to re-enter the economy, it's going to be a slow process. We're not going back to the sales levels that we saw, you know, a month or two ago. And even on the income front, I think that could take some time. So I think the market is underappreciating the economic damage that we have to deal with in the weeks and months ahead. And it's mostly, I think, moving on the positive news of the outbreak of the virus and the initial development that we started to see in the oil patch between Russia and Saudi Arabia and Mexico. But as you mentioned, oil is now down below $20 a barrel. You know, I'm sorry, but oil companies in the U.S. are going to have a hard time paying their interest and paying to mature their debt at low oil prices.
Yeah. And you may have heard the interview that we did with Felix Zuloff, but he was talking about on our FS Insider program that when it comes to the various recovery scenarios that we could see, a V-shaped, U, W, or L, right? Those are going from best case scenario, V, L-shaped would be worst case scenario, more like depression. He's lining up more towards a longer protracted recovery. Where do you lie on that if we were to think going from, you know, V-shaped recovery to worst case scenario, more of an L?
I think Felix is right. And I've seen some other data coming from Moody's Analytics, who, you know, in terms of their opinion, they think we're not going to hit new highs in economic growth until 2023. That essentially this will be a three-year process to work through the unemployment, work through the hit to retail sales and production. And that the GDP level that we hit going into this will take years to get back to. So when you think about that, that's a pretty sobering outlook. You know, there's several risks that Moody's is looking at. They're worried about potential deflation, which is a huge risk in a highly indebted society. They're also looking at a secondary outbreak. They're also concerned about some stress in the shadow banking sector of the U.S. economy. So there's a lot of stress out there that I think the markets are underappreciating. Even with that stress, I still don't think we're going to hit new lows in the market with all the stimulus. But essentially what I'm arguing is that we probably shouldn't be as high as we are right now. I think there's just a lot the market is completely ignoring, much like the market ignored the outbreak of the coronavirus in China and even initially in other parts like South Korea. And it was only when it really started to hit our shores as well as Italy that the market started to pay attention to this. You know, if you look at the unemployment rate, it's up there. The amount that are hitting new claims is in the millions every week. So I think the market is overlooking this. And I think the rally that we had is probably overdone. And a lot of the measures that I look at had peaked last week. They're not rallying with the market. So I do think the market's vulnerable here at this level. You know, if people are overweight equities, this would probably be a great time to take some money off the table. But at the same time, I'm not in the gloom and doom camp. I don't think we're going to hit new lows in the market. I do think we're going to kind of bounce around and trace out a bottom here for the next month or so. But I think as we get into May and going into June, I think we're going to have a decent rally as we get continued improvement in economic data, where things are less bad, just like we're still dealing with the outbreak, but we're, you know, the daily growth rate is beginning to peak. I think we'll see that with unemployment. You know, unemployment claims, the weekly change will peak and begin to slow down, but we're still going to be seeing a huge surge in unemployment claims, just less bad maybe than the week before. So I think we've still got that ahead of us, but I think that's what will kind of cause the market to rally probably a month from now as we kind of pick back up, is if that will probably start to see a peak in the damage to the economy and some improvement from that standpoint.
Given that and what you said about investors might want to lighten up on equities, what is it that we're doing at Financial Sense Wealth Management?
Well, at our firm, we put on a hedge about a week or so ago, and that was because we were slightly overweight, a neutral position. We were also starting to pick up individual stocks, which are going to be more volatile than the market. So we wanted to essentially kind of tap the brakes a bit. And what we're going to be looking at is for the market to pull in at some point during the rest of this month, remove that hedge and start picking up more equities and putting more money to work. One of the things that we're also doing is shifting away from international exposure to equities and focusing more on domestic. And the reason for that is the amount of stimulus that we have here in the U.S. is far greater than what we're seeing in the EM part of the world, as well as developed parts of the world. And the other thing that we're seeing is if you look at U.S. markets, you know, I believe one of the reasons why we've been a consistent outperformer has been the fact of our huge weighting in technology. I still think we're going to see technology be a strong outperformer in a slow growth environment. given the consistency of their cash flows. And so I think that's part of the reason why we want to overweight U.S. versus international is the weighting in technology. If you look at international indices, whether that's emerging markets or developed markets, one of the biggest sectors that you commonly see in countries is financials. And I think we're going to see interest rates stay on the low end for short-term interest rates for quite some time, and economic growth being low, as well as seeing still some potential solvency issues on loans from that banks have issued. And so that's why I think the banks will struggle here for the next several months, and likely why we'll see an underperformance in international versus U.S.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you for coming on our show, giving us an update on this edition of Smart Macro. Just for those who are tuning in for the first time, we speak with Chris Poplava, our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, every 2 weeks to get an update on his outlook and what we're doing at our firm. With that said, Chris, if any of our listeners are interested in following more of your work or speaking with you about your outlook or how Financial Sense Wealth Management can assist them, what would be the best way to get in touch with you?
They can give us a call at 888-486-3939, or they can shoot me an email at chris.poplava@financialsense.com.
As always, if you have any feedback for us on what we discussed today, go to financialsense.com and hit contact us. You can also email me directly at cris@financialsense. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense NewsHour, the wide range of guests and topics that we discuss to keep you ahead of the trends and ahead of the herd at all times and know what's really going on with the financial markets and the economy. Don't forget about our premium podcast as well that airs 3 days during the week, where we interview top investment strategists, book authors, and industry experts from around the world. People like Martin Armstrong, David Rosenberg, Russell Napier, Gary Schilling, Jim Bianco, Felix Zuloff, and a long list of other names. If you want to sign up for that, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.